This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Golden Prey by John Sanford. Read for you by Richard Ferrone. Chapter 1. Garvin Poole slipped out of bed, got his lighter off the fireplace mantle, and walked in his underwear through the dark house to the kitchen, where he took a joint out of a sugar jar, then continued to the garden door. He opened it as quietly as he could, but it chimed once, not an alarm so much as a notification. He stepped out onto the patio and continued along the flagstone walk to his workshed. Poole was an inch shy of 6 feet, with broad shoulders and big hands of a high school wrestler, which he'd never been, and now a hint of a hard beer gut. He still had thick reddish-brown hair over blue eyes and used a beard trimmer for the three-day look. Women liked him. He couldn't go to Whole Foods without picking up a conversation. The flagstones underfoot were cool but dry, not much rain this year. The moon was up high and bright over the garden wall, and he could hear faintly from well off in the distance the stuttering midnight sound of Rihanna singing Work. He opened the shed door, turned on the light, sat down in the office chair, fired up the joint, and looked at the guitar he was building. He'd been sitting there for a half minute or so when Dora Bach said, "Gar?" She stepped through the open door, buck naked the way she slept. "What you doing?" He said, "Come on, sit down." She sat in a wooden chair and didn't cross her legs, and he took a long look and then said, "I'm going back to work. One time." Oh, boy. Now she crossed her legs. Box had a hard time getting through the day without being rubbed or squeezed, but business was business. "It might have been a mistake coming here," he said, waving the joint at the workshop. "I have been thinking about it a lot for the last month or so. I like it, but we should have left the country, gotten out completely." "There's no other place you like that we could go," Buck said. "Costa Rica was supposed to be the best, but you thought it sucked. Snakes. Oh, God, snakes. Anyway, you don't even like most of the states, Gar. Where'd we go that we'd like?" He shook his head. "I don't know. Some place crookeder than here." "You know a place crookeder than Dallas?" "Sure. There are places in this world where you can pay the cops to kill people for you," he said. His voice squeaked as he simultaneously tried to talk and to hold the smoke in his lungs. "Where you can do anything you want." "You wouldn't want to live in those places. What brought this on?" Poole took a drag on the joint and said, "I put 10 years of money into gold. And now I go around trying to cash the gold out, and there aren't enough places to do that, not inside a day's drive. Every time I cash a coin, the guys are giving me looks, you know. I've been back too many times. They know what I'm doing, that I'm cashing out hot money. They don't say anything, but they know." "We could drive somewhere else," Buck suggested. "Oklahoma City, Houston. Basically the same problem. People are looking at you, remembering you," Poole said. Silence for a while, then Buck said, "I thought the gold was smart." "I did too, back at the start. The cops were tearing up everything south of Kentucky looking for me, and gold seemed flexible, good anywhere. Maybe I was thinking about it too much." They'd had variations of the talk before. Gold coins were anonymous, portable, no serial numbers. He could get small bills for gold. It kept its value over time, and it was saleable almost anywhere. He hadn't seen the problem with being looked at and remembered. "I didn't see that coming. cashing out month after month. We need $10,000 a month to keep our heads above water. That's 9 or 10 coins a month right now, he said. If we were in the right country, we could cash it all out at once, set up a phony company, pretend we earned the money, give ourselves salaries, pay taxes, and maybe someday come back to the States under different names. Sounds sketchy, she said, and give me a hit. He passed the joint, and she took a hit, held it, breathed out, bit off another one, passed it back, uncrossed her legs, and unconsciously trailed her fingers across her pussy. The soft smell of marijuana went well with the fleshy damp odor of the nighttime garden. If you're thinking about moving us out of the country, then why are you thinking about taking a job? Because I really don't want to leave here. The job's an alternative, Poole said. Tell me.
Sturgill called. He sees an opportunity.
How much? Can't tell from a distance, but he thinks at least 2 or 3. Maybe more. Maybe a lot more. He orally capitalized the numbers. 2 meant 2 million. 3 meant 3 million. Box shook her head. That much, it's gotta be risky.
Sturge says it's pretty soft. Sturge always knows what he's talking about, Box conceded.
When would you do it? Either 1 week or a month and a week. The money's there 1 day a month, Poole said. Where?
Biloxi.
I like Biloxi. Like that jambalaya, passed the joint. He passed it over, and she bit off some smoke, played it through her nose. She handed the joint back and rubbed her arms, goosebumps in the cool night. The thing is, we'd get cash, all cash. We could spend it without anybody looking at us or looking for us, Poole said. Stay here, figure out a way to move the gold. We get a couple mil out of Biloxi, we could take 8 or 10 years to liquidate the gold, and when that's done, we got a lifetime.
I don't like you going back to work, but it's better than moving to Russia or some weird foreign shit like that, Buck said.
She stood up and stretched. She had the body for it, too. Long, lanky, lightly freckled, a dishwater blonde with small pink nipples and only a wispy trace of pubic hair.
I'm going back to bed. Don't stay up too late.
Poole bought high-quality guitar parts, assembled them, then began meticulously carving and staining the surfaces, creating comic book-like custom scenes. He'd learned woodworking at what Tennessee called, with a straight face, a youth development center. Prison for kids was what it was. When Box was gone, he sat looking at his latest work. A bass fishing comic being done for a pro fisherman who was also a guitar collector. It needed another 2 weeks. He'd have to put it aside for now. He reached across the shed and picked up a 20-year-old Les Paul, touched the power switch on an amp with his big toe, pulled some quiet blues out of the guitar. He liked the music, liked the woodwork, liked the smell of the lacquer. If he'd made a business of it, he figured he'd make almost half as much as an elementary school teacher. He went to Biloxi. Biloxi, Mississippi, and the smell of the sea. Sturgill Darling was sitting at a round corner table in the oyster bar a block off the Gulf of Mexico, amid the steam and sour stinks of both raw and cooking seafood. He looked like a slow, lazy hick, and stupid, too, with his farm-work forearms, bowl-cut brown hair, and worn, loose-cut jeans. He wore a floppy plaid shirt and yellow work boots, and sprawled back in the chair,
knees locked and feet straight out in front of him, grinning at the passing crowd with teeth as yellow as his boots. A dumbass for sure, an ignorant peckerwood. A mistake that any number of people had made to their lasting regret. Poole took the chair beside him, held up a finger to a barmaid, and pointed at Darling's glass and said, "Give me one of those." When she had gone, Darling asked, "What do you think?" Poole was wearing sunglasses over a gray-flecked red week-old beard and under a long-billed fishing hat, the better to defeat surveillance cameras. He'd spent most of the day scouting the scene of the would-be job. "We can do it, if it's no more guys than you say. How in the hell did you find this?" "I knew the blow was coming in through Galveston, but I couldn't see any money going out. They're bringing in anything up to 500 kilos at a time. That's, let's see, about 1,100 pounds. Off big-game fishing boats that meet with these boats from Honduras. Anyway, I found a guy in Houston who could sell me an ounce, and then I watched the guy he got his product from, and watched the guy he got his product from, and by the time I got to the end of the line, I was watching guys who could sell you 100 kilos if you had the cash. Then I watched them backwards. Watch the wholesalers paying the money guys. The money guys never touch the dope. And watch the money guys move it to the pickup guys who travel up and down the coast from Charleston around to Galveston, with Biloxi in the middle. Watched it come down here, to the bank. Poole thought about that, admitted to himself that Darling had a talent that he, Poole, barely understood, the ability to uncover the footprints that could lead to a treasure. But Poole also understood that he had a talent that Darling didn't, the will to act. Darling could uncover all the dope banks he wished, but he'd never go into a robbery as the leader, the designated shooter. That took somebody like Poole. "How do they move the dope?" Poole asked. "RV. Couple of middle-aged lesbo chicks. Got some prison tats on them. They look competent. They got double-load tires on the truck. I believe there might be some armor on it. These girls got a look about them. I believe they're carrying some artillery." "Huh." That's the way Poole would have done it. He even liked the lesbo touch. Cops were usually too sexist and too lazy to pay much attention to a couple of chicks, and some of those goddamn dykes could take your face apart with their teeth. "But we don't want the dope, even if we could take it," Darling said. "We got no way to get rid of it. Not that much of it. And the dope handlers never see the cash, except at the lowest levels." "Just asking." 500 kilos, what's that?" He closed his eyes for a few seconds, then said, 12 million, more or less, if it's not stepped on too hard. "What about the money?" "They take no chances with the money. They move it in increments. There are 4 bankers who travel around, meet the collectors who get the cash from the top-end retailers. The bankers and everybody else move in rental cars. I doubt they ever have as much as 250,000 in any one pickup. Then it comes together down here once a month. The people here bundle it and send it out on the last Sunday of the month," Darling said. "Regular as a railroad. Put it on a charter boat, drop it with a Honduran boat out in the Gulf. Whole operation is run by the Arce brothers. Hector and Simon, out of Puerto Cortez." "Honduras?" "Yes. The brothers aren't real big, not like the Mexican cartels, but they're smart and mean. Keep their heads down and their mouths shut, nothing flashy about them. Pay off the Honduran cops and army, everybody's cool. Poole thought about that in the silent, smiling, calculating way that Southerners had, and finally said, "Well, looks like you found the honeypot all right."
"Probably." Darling gave Poole his lazy look. "You sure you're up for this? It's been a while."
"Yep, I am. There'll be one outside, three inside. They all got guns," Darling said. "I've watched them for 3 months, always the same."
"We gunned up?" Poole asked.
"Yeah, got your favorites, bought out of Chicago brand new. Glock 23s suppressed, loaded up with 180s. I did the reloads myself, so they'll be going out subsonic to kill some of the noise. I thought maybe Sam Brooks, if you think we need another gun."
"Don't need him, and I don't like him," Poole said. "I'll need a day to work with the guns. You got a place I can do that?"
"Knew you'd ask," Darling said. "I got a place so far out in the woods that the fucking owls get lost." The barmaid brought Poole's beer, and he thanked her, and they waited until she moved away. Then Poole said, "Shoot the next couple days, move Sunday night."
"Sounds good."
"About the cut, what do you think?"
Poole grinned and tapped the beer, swallowed, and said, "I won't argue with you."
"I'm thinking 60-40, since I did all the setup," Darling said. "Took me 9 months. I started working on it way last winter."
"Fair enough."
"Hot damn," Darling said, with his yellow grin.
"The Dixie Hicks are back in action.
What's left of them, anyway."
Poole laughed and kicked back and said, "You remember that time with Ronnie outside of Charleston?"
The Dixie Hicks had all kinds of war stories, some funny, some sad. In most of them, even the funny ones, somebody wound up dead, like Ronnie. Three Georgia state troopers, hot on his ass, riding a stolen 2009 556-horse Cadillac CTSV down a rocky gulch in the Georgia Piedmont, rolling over and over and over until the car looked like a shiny sausage. $30,000 in bank money exploded all over the interior, along with Ronnie's brains. Good old Ronnie. Too bad he killed himself.
Poole and Darling drove north into the trees on the following day, and Poole went to work with the guns. He'd laid off for a while, but killing is like riding a bicycle. Once you got it, you got it. Darling had gotten inside the counting house one dark night when the bankers weren't there and said they counted at a table about 32 feet from the door in the outer wall. He'd checked it with a tape measure. At 32 feet, or any shorter distance, Poole wouldn't have to worry about where to shoot. He'd hold dead on and pull the trigger. They set up some human-shaped paper targets out in the woods, stapled to pine trees, and Poole worked at it, getting back in the rhythm. From the first shots, he was accurate enough, but he had to work on speed. He did that, and he knew how to do it. Slow at first, feeling the weapons, feeling the rounds going out, feeling the recoil. Then a little quicker, and a little quicker. Darling looking at a stopwatch. Darling was almost scholarly about it. "You're at less than half a second," he said, holding a stopwatch. "You know better than me, but it looks like you're still trying to be too fast. You over-aim, then you've got to correct."
Poole nodded. "I can feel that."
He would shoot a box of 40s, the same stuff he'd use for the real thing, and then take a break, walk around, shake out his hands. At the end of the day, he could get off 4 accurate killing shots in a little more than a fifth of a second. Good enough. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina went through Biloxi like an H-bomb, a 30-foot storm surge taking out a good part of the town. North of the main harbor was mostly bare ground that once had houses. Here and there a building remained, but not in its original state, and there weren't a lot of people around. Grace Baptist Church once had a fieldstone foundation up over head height, with a white clapboard structure above that, dating back to the 1890s. The frame structure, if it hadn't been atomized, was probably somewhere up in the Kentucky woods, having ridden away on Katrina's winds like Dorothy's house in The Wizard of Oz. The bottom of the church, the shoulder-high fieldstone foundation, remained in place, its original floor now covered with tar paper, serving as the roof. The church, foundation and floor only, had been sold to a man who collected antique cars and needed a place to store them. When the Honduras cartel was looking for a place to put their bank, they made the car collector an offer he didn't even think of refusing. Not that he was frightened, he was simply greedy, and the offer was that good. The spot had two great benefits. There were never any cops around, because there was nothing to steal, vandalize, or hang out at, and you could walk down to your boat in 5 minutes. Sunday night was going out only, with four men doing the work. For most of the evening, two of the four men would be posted at opposite corners of the former church, seated between carefully placed limelight hydrangeas. They both were carrying guns, at least two each, Darling thought, probably high-capacity semi-autos with suppressors, and were linked with radio headsets. Late in the evening, Darling said, one would go inside with the other two, while one remained outside, seated behind a bush by a door in the old church's basement. He thought the three were probably packing the money after the first two had counted and bundled it. Around midnight, the outside guard would go inside, and a few minutes later, they'd all walk out of the building, carrying at least one and often two suitcases each. The walk down to the waterfront took 5 minutes. There, they'd get on a fishing boat. 2 or 3 minutes later, they'd be off the boat and strolling through the quiet Sunday night back to the old church building. Three of them would wait there while the fourth man went out to a black Lincoln Navigator that they'd parked behind a building a few hundred yards away. He'd pick up the other three, and they'd drive over to the Hampton Inn, where they'd stay overnight before dispersing to wherever they lived. The boat with the money would ease out of the marina in the early morning hours and disappear over the southern horizon. Darling had considered the possibility of robbing the boat, but thought the money might be inside a safe or otherwise hard to get at. Taking it could get complicated, and they didn't have the time or the organization for that. At 10 o'clock Sunday night, Poole and Darling slipped out of an abandoned FEMA trailer where they'd spent most of the afternoon and evening eating Subway sandwiches and drinking smart water and pissing in the no longer connected toilet at the other end of the trailer. They were both dressed in dark clothes, but nothing unusual or too tactical. Black Levi's jeans and long-sleeved navy polo shirts. They were wearing ski masks, which weren't often seen in Biloxi, the town being woefully short on ski slopes, and light blue surgeon's gloves. Poole carried two pistols. Darling carried one, all suppressed. 9s for Darling, 40s for Poole. The guns, with the custom suppressors, were 14 inches long in their hands. They were shooting wet, having sprayed water down the suppressors before screwing them back on the gun barrels in the 2 minutes or so before they left the trailer. The suppressors would be even quieter wet than dry. Only one guard remained outside. He was sitting behind a haggard pink rose bush adjacent to the door. They came in from the blind side of the foundation, Darling trailing as Poole led the way. At the corner, 20 feet from the access door, Poole peeked. Because of the rosebush, he couldn't see the guard, but neither could the guard see him.
Moving with glacial slowness, he duck-walked down along the wall. 10 feet out, he could smell the other man, a smoker, but still not see him. When he was 3 feet out, Poole rose carefully to his feet, back against the stone wall, looked down. The guard never knew what hit him. Poole reached over the rose bush and shot him in the head, a golf clap pop from the gun. Darling came up, quiet as Poole had been, didn't even glance at the dead man. 3 more men inside. They needed instant control, couldn't abide with chaos, with some crazy gunfight, needed to get on top of the other 3 immediately. Darling took the door. He breathed.
Ready?
The door would not be locked. They'd seen the guards go in and out without knocking or using keys. Poole got square to it, a gun in each hand.
Now,
Poole whispered. Darling reached one gloved hand out to the doorknob, turned it, pushed. It squeaked, and then Poole was inside, both guns up. He could see the 3 men 30 feet away, sitting side by side at a table. They all looked up, maybe expecting to see their outside man, but all they saw was a stranger in black who said not a single word, but simply opened fire. Darling was back up. Poole did the killing. Darling kicked the door shut as Poole shot each of the 3 men once, in a grand total of a half second, 2 shots from his right hand, 1 from his left, a little slower than he'd been on the paper targets. A half second was almost fast enough, but not quite. One of the men grabbed a 9 from the counting table and got off a single wild shot. The bullet pinched the underside of Poole's left arm, but the man who fired it was already dead by the time Poole realized he'd been shot. He was striding toward the counting table when a young girl, maybe 6 years old, bolted toward the back of the building from where she'd been sitting on the floor with a golden-haired Barbie doll. She knew she wouldn't make it, though, stopped, turned, and said,
"You killed Grandpa."
"Sorry, kid," Poole said, and shot her in the head. Darling came up from behind, said, the shock riding through his voice,
"Fucking A, Gar. Did you have to do that?"
"Yeah, I did. She was old enough to raise the cops," Poole said. He felt nothing for the kid, but needed to mollify Darling. "If we tied her up, she might starve to death before somebody found her." This was the best. Darling stared at the Raggedy Ann body of the kid, wrapped in a white dress now spattered with blood that looked like red flowers woven into the pale fabric.
"Fucking A. We could have called somebody." "Wake up, man. It's done. Get the fucking suitcases," Poole said. "We gotta move. Motherfucker got lucky and hit me."
"Oh, Jesus. Bad?"
"No, but I've got to look. Get the suitcases going."
Poole couldn't push the shirt sleeve up high enough to see the wound, so he pulled the polo shirt over his head. He found an inch-long groove on the underside of his arm. It was bleeding, but the bullet hadn't actually penetrated. A flesh wound, as they said on the old TV westerns. Darling was shoveling loose cash from the tabletop into a suitcase, stopping every few seconds to peer at the dead girl as though hoping she'd show a sign of life. He brought himself back, glanced at Poole, and asked again,
"How bad?"
"Not bad. Need to rip up a shirt or something. Not much more than a band-aid job. We got a bunch of shirts laying on the floor. Rip one up," Darling said. Poole ripped a piece off the girl's skirt, figuring that probably had the least body contact with its former owner and was less likely to carry an infection. Poole thought of things like that, even under stress. He made a neat tie bandage out of it. It was really all he needed. He pulled his shirt back over his head, and together he and Darling checked the take. Poole had nothing more to say except,
"Holy shit.
You got that right, brother," Darling said. "Way more than I thought. Heavy, though. Can you carry?"
Hell yes. It hurts, but it's not bad. He was wrong about carrying the money. The suitcases must have weighed 40 or 50 pounds each, about like a deep-cycle bass boat battery, and there were 6 of them instead of the 3 or 4 they'd expected. He could carry one with each hand, but not run with them. The one on his shot arm dragged him down, the grazing shot now burning like fire. Darling, carrying 4 suitcases, 1 in each hand and 1 bundled under each armpit, hurried ahead and kept hissing back, "Come on, come on!" The stolen truck was 200 yards away. Darling loaded his suitcases and ran back to Poole, grabbed the suitcase on Poole's bad side, and together they made it back to the truck. They drove slowly, they were professionals, out of Biloxi. They left the stolen truck at a rest area on I-10, transferring the cases to Darling's long-bed Chevy. Darling had put a false floor in the camper, and they emptied the cash through the concealed hatch, closed the hatch, and threw the suitcases on top of it. Heading west again, they stripped off the surgeon's gloves and threw them out the windows as small rubber balls. The ski masks went after them, one at a time, miles apart. 20 miles farther along, Darling took an exit that curled down a side road to a bridge. They threw the guns off the bridge into the narrow, dark river and headed back to the interstate. Farther up the way, they left the 5 suitcases sitting side by side on a sidewalk in Slidell, Louisiana, with a sign on top that said, "Free." A little more than an hour after killing the 4 men and the girl, they were out of Slidell, still moving west. "What the fuck's wrong with you?" Poole asked, looking over at Darling, who was hunched over the steering wheel, his mouth in a fixed grimace. "I raised some girls. I can't get that little girl out of my head," Darling said. "Come on, man. What difference does the age make? She's just another witness." "I know, I know. Just skizzed me out, man. I keep seeing her. I'll be okay." Poole peered at him for a minute, then said, "Think about it this way. It's done. Can't be undone. It's history." They stopped at a 24-hour Walmart supercenter in Baton Rouge, off to one side of the parking lot, between 2 other pickups, climbed into the back of the truck and dug the money out from under the false floor. Most of it was in hundreds, well used and a little greasy, bundled into bricks of $10,000 each. There was also a pile of loose money that Darling had scraped off the counting table. They counted out a few bundles, agreed that they were $10,000 each, despite varying in size depending on the value of the individual bills in each bundle. They counted the bundles. There were 780 of them. 7,800,000, Darling breathed. "Man, those greasers are gonna be pissed when they hear about this." "Fuck 'em," Poole said, and he laughed aloud. Darling sat back on the truck floor and said, "Tell you what, man, forget the 60-40. I never thought we'd get this much. Let's cut it 50-50 and I'll keep the loose change. Can't be more than a couple hundred thousand there." "You are a fine and honorable man," Poole said. "Let's do it." He held up a fist, and Darling bumped it, and they split up the money. Box was at a Baton Rouge Marriott. When the counting was done and the money repacked in 2 canvas duffel bags, Poole called her.
"All done," he said. "I've been up for 3 hours, nervouser than a nun in a penguin shoot," she said. "Where you at?"
"Right where we're supposed to be," Poole said.
"You do good?"
she asked. "Better than that," Poole said.
10 minutes, she said.
She was 12 minutes. Darling went on his way, and 5 hours later, Poole and Box had cut I-20 west of Shreveport and rolled across the Texas border on the way back home to Dallas, listening to Paul Thorne singing Bull Mountain Bridge on the Sirius satellite radio. A ton of money in the back. Money, Poole thought, that would last his entire life. Chapter 2 Three locals were sitting on the wide wooden porch on a green park bench to the right of the bar's front door. An overhead fluorescent light buzzed like a dentist's drill, but didn't seem to bother them much. All three of them wore trucker hats and were drinking beer from plastic cups. They stopped to watch when Lucas Davenport rolled his black Mercedes SUV across the gravel parking lot and into a vacant slot between a new Ford F-150 and a battered yellow Cadillac sedan old enough to have fins. Lucas got out of the truck, clicked lock on the Benz's key fob, and took in the bar. In any other place, Cooters would have been a dive. Out here it wasn't, because it was the only bar in Ova, the place where everybody went, from the janitors to the bankers. Built like an old Mississippi River Delta-style house, it featured a wide front porch with an overhanging roof, warped, unpainted plank walls, and neon beer signs in the windows. A million white, thumbnail-sized moths were beating themselves to death around the light over the heads of the three men, but they didn't seem to notice. In a movie, you'd expect an outbreak of rednecks, crackers, peckerwoods with ropes and axe handles. Located 200 yards from one of the rare exits off I-55, with a 20-foot-wide red and white sign that blinked Cooters, then Drink, the bar also attracted anyone who might be running along the interstate between St. Louis and Memphis who might get shaky after 2 hours without alcohol. Lucas crunched across the gravel parking lot, climbed the porch steps, and nodded at the three men. He didn't have to get close to smell the spilt beer. One of the three checked out Lucas's suit, tie, and black Lucchese lizard-skin cowboy boots and said, "Evening, sir," slurring his words enough that Lucas thought the men might not be out on the bench voluntarily. Lucas said, "Evening, boys." "Nice ride you got there," the middle one said. "Thank you. Wanna buy it?" The three all chuckled. They couldn't afford one of the fucking tires, much less the rest of the truck, but the offer gave them the warm glow of economic equality. Lucas nodded again, said, "Take her easy," went inside, chose the least sticky-looking stool toward the end of the bar, and sat down. The bartender, a thin man with a gold eye tooth and a black string tie, came over and asked, "What do you need?" "Make me a decent margarita." Lucas loosened his necktie. "I can do that. Though some folks think the indecent ones are even better," the bartender said. When Lucas didn't crack back, he said, "One decent margarita coming up." The bartender had started to step away when Lucas asked, "How do you pronounce the name of this place?" The bartender's face took on the look that people get when they're asked a really, really stupid question. "Cooters?" Lucas laughed. No, the town. Oxvazies." "Oh, jeez, you had me going there for a minute," the bartender said. "It's a French, and it's Ova." "Ova. Always wondered whenever I saw the sign," Lucas said. "Yep, Ova." He looked at Lucas a little more closely and saw a big blue-eyed guy whose dark hair was threaded with gray at the temples. The bartender guessed that he might be in his late 40s or early 50s. His nose had been broken at one time or another, and a thin white scar ran down his forehead across his eyebrow. Another scar, a round one, sat just above the loosened knot of his necktie. And the suit.
The suit he was wearing was undoubtedly the most expensive suit to come through the door in the last 10 years. He went off to find some tequila. Lucas looked around the place. 15 booths, 12 bar stools, a couple of game machines in the back, plank floors that creaked when somebody walked across them, and the vagrant smell of rum crooks and deep-fried fish sticks. He was the only man in the place with a necktie and without a hat. Lucas sat alone, buying 4 margaritas over the span of 45 minutes, and making 2 trips to the men's room, or what he hoped was the men's room. The only identifying signs were a picture of a cat on one restroom door and a rooster on the other. He was halfway through the 4th margarita when Shirley MacDonald eased up on a stool 2 down. Lucas looked her over, smiled, and nodded. She was a skinny young blonde, very young. Black eyebrows, too much eyeshadow, crystalline green eyes. Crayola red lipstick not quite inside the lines. She looked fragile, easily broken. Might already have been busted a couple of times. She wore a white blouse that verged on transparent, no obvious bra straps, jeans torn at the thigh and knee, and sandals. Not a debutante. She asked, "How y'all doing?" "I'm doing fine," Lucas said, "for a man this far from the comforts of home."
"You got a cigarette?"
she asked. "I don't smoke," Lucas said.
"Damn it, I'll have to smoke one of my own."
She grinned at him and fished a turquoise pack of American Spirits out of her purse. One of her big front teeth wasn't quite straight, but the irregularity made her even more attractive, which she certainly knew.
"The goddamn things are so expensive now. I can only afford about a pack a week."
"Buy you a drink, though," Lucas said.
"I was waiting to hear that,"
she said. She lifted a finger to the bartender and said,
"Eddie."
"Yeah, I know. Expensive and sweet."
"You are such a sugar bear," she said.
She knocked a cigarette out of the pack, tapped the end on the bar to pack in the tobacco, and asked Lucas,
"What's your story, big guy?"
"I'm just a guy," Lucas said.
"A married guy,"
she said as she fired up the cigarette. He was wearing a ring. "Yeah, someone."
"Only someone?"
"You know how that goes," Lucas said. The bartender came over, put down a tall, dark drink that smelled of sugar, and handed her a toothpick on which he had speared 3 maraschino cherries. She sucked off 2 of them, then took a sip of the drink, and Lucas asked, "What the heck is that?"
"Jim Beam single barrel," the bartender said, "and Coca-Cola. We call it an Ova Libra."
Lucas winced, turned back to MacDonald, and said, "What's your name?"
"Trist," she said, sucking off the 3rd cherry. "It's French, like Ova."
The whole cherry-sucking thing was both hilarious and the tiniest bit erotic, but it would have taken a mean bastard to laugh at her. Lucas didn't. The girl, he thought, was probably younger than his daughter Letty, now in her 2nd year at Stanford. Anyway, one thing led to another, and Lucas never did make it to Memphis. At midnight, after a few more margaritas and 3 more trips to the Rooster Room, he and MacDonald wound up at the Motel 6 on the other side of I-55. Lucas hadn't more than gotten the room door shut when the girl popped the belt on her jeans and stripped them off with her sandals, then pulled the blouse off. Lucas was still wearing his suit coat, though he'd stuffed his tie in his coat pocket.
"What do you think?"
Trist asked, fists on her hips. She had pale, cone-shaped breasts, tipped with the same pink color as a Barbie doll butt. They stood straight out and wobbled when she spoke. "How old are you, anyway?" Lucas asked.
15,
she said. Then she snatched up her jeans and started screaming her head off. 3 seconds later, as she huddled in the corner with her jeans held to her breasts, the cops came through the door. With a key, Lucas noticed. No point in kicking down a perfectly good motel room door. The first cop through the door was a tall, rangy blonde guy with muscles in his face. He looked angry with the world and willing to do something about it, preferably with a gun. He had a flat-top haircut with well-waxed front edges, and he had a big blued automatic in his right hand. He pointed it at Lucas's head and shouted, "On the wall, asshole! On the wall!" Lucas thought, oh, shit. Because if the guy screwed up, Lucas could wind up dead. He turned, hands over his head, facing the wall, and the cop yelled, "Hands on the wall, asswipe! Push your feet back! Push your feet back! Wait on your hands!" Lucas said, "I didn't know." "Shut the fuck up!" The second cop through the door was shorter than the first, roly-poly, with a reddish mustache and sparse red hair. He looked like a woodchuck, or maybe a beaver, Lucas thought. Both cops were wearing chest cameras. The woodchuck asked Trist, "You all right, girl?" Trist, speaking to the camera, said,
"He said we were gonna watch a movie. He tried to force me."
"Put your clothes back on, man," the short cop said.
Lucas was leaning on the wall with both hands, but turned his head toward the girl and saw her grin at the cop. The blonde cop had put his gun back in his holster, patted Lucas's hips and around his belt line and down his legs, then said,
"Hands behind your back. You've been trying to fuck with this little high school girl, huh? Well, tonight's your unlucky night."
"I'm telling you, she was drinking and smoking in the bar." The cop jerked him around and popped him in the gut with a lazy right fist. Not too hard, but hard enough to bend Lucas over.
"Shut up! You talk when I tell you to."
Lucas eased back up. "I'm telling you." Boom! Another shot in the gut, harder this time.
"You deaf? I said you talk when I tell you."
"Don't hit me again," Lucas said. "Don't hit me again." The blonde cop sneered and said,
"I ought to smack the shit out of you."
The woodchuck muttered,
"Mind the cameras, Todd." "I don't think no jury's gonna give me a hard time for spanking a goddamn dirtbag who comes to town and tries to hump a 10th grader. That ought to be good for 15 years, in my humble opinion."
"I did not." Boom! Another shot in the gut. This was getting old. The woodchuck said to the girl, "You're gonna have to ride with me over to the sheriff's, girl. We'll need a statement from you."
"He pulled my pants off,"
she wailed with all the sincerity of a cup of lemon-flavored jello. The deputy put Lucas in a holding cell, hands still pinned behind his back.
"Don't go anywhere," he said before slamming the steel door.
Lucas sat on the concrete bench and waited. The cell smelled like beer vomit and Clorox. His wife had ordered him to try yoga after he had quit his job with Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension as a stress reliever. That hadn't worked worth a damn, but he'd been given a calming mantra by the yoga instructor, and he tried it out now. "Mind like moon, mind like moon." After a while, it made him laugh. He couldn't see his watch, but he thought a half hour had passed before he heard people outside the door. He knew the routine. They were letting him stew and worry about consequences. He heard somebody tapping the keypad lock. The door popped open, and another tall blonde cop looked in at him. This one was 25 years older than the first cop, but there was a family resemblance, including the tense facial muscles and the well-waxed flat top.
The first two cops had been wearing khaki uniforms with shoulder patches that said Ova County. This man was wearing a sport coat and tan slacks.
"Bring him out of there, son," the man said.
The first big blonde cop, Todd, came around the door and said,
"Stand up, asshole."
Lucas stood, and the cop hooked him by the arm and led him out into the hallway. Then they all followed the man in the sport coat down the hall to an office where the man sat down behind a desk. A nameplate on the desk said, "Sheriff Robert Bob Turner." There were a dozen pictures of him on the back wall, either receiving awards or standing with some dignitary. The sheriff asked,
"Where's Trist?"
"Waiting room with Scott," Todd said.
"Bring her in here."
Todd went to get her, and Lucas said, "Sheriff Turner, I did not—"
"Shut the fuck up," Turner said. "In this office, you speak when you're spoken to."
Todd was back 10 seconds later with the woodchuck cop and the girl. Turner looked at Trist and asked,
"What'd he do to you?"
"He said we'd get some beer and go watch HBO. And when I got in his room, he started pulling off my clothes. He almost had me naked. I was screaming. And Todd showed up just in time," she said.
The sheriff looked at Lucas and asked,
"Is that right?"
Lucas shook his head. "No, it's not right."
"You're saying she's lying?"
Turner asked.
"That's what I'm saying," Lucas said.
"Huh.
Well, Todd, what do you have to say?"
"We were over at the Motel 6 doing a routine check, and I was walking along that walkway there, and I heard Shirley, Trist, cry out, and the door was unlocked, and I went through it, and I found her naked as the day she was born, and this guy here all over her."
The sheriff looked at Lucas.
"That right?"
"No. She took her own clothes off and started screaming," Lucas said. "I was not all over her. I was standing by the door, and she was on the other side of the room."
"You're saying Todd's lying, too?"
"Yes." Todd reached over and slapped Lucas's face. Lucas half-spun away, trying to keep his balance, which was harder than he thought it might be with his hands pinned behind him. The slap stung, but didn't do any damage. Todd was pissing him off, though. The sheriff puffed himself up and noisily sighed, then said,
"Well, looks like we got ourselves a situation."
He turned to Trist.
"You pretty messed up, girl?"
"Hell yeah," she said. "Nothing like this ever happened before. I'm pretty much a virgin."
The sheriff gazed at her for a bit, then said to Scott,
"Go sit her down in the waiting room again. You stay with her. Me and Todd will interview the subject here."
When they were gone, the sheriff asked Todd,
"You check his ID?"
"Not yet. I was gonna do that when you got here."
"Well, check it. Let's see who we got."
"My name's Lucas," Lucas began.
"Shut up,"
the sheriff said. Lucas carried a bifold alligator hide wallet in his front pants pocket, and Todd slipped it out, opened it, and said,
"No cash, nothing but credit cards and a Minnesota driver's license. Lucas Davenport, Mississippi River Boulevard, St. Paul."
"Well, let's see what we got on Mr. Davenport," the sheriff said.
He turned to a computer, tapped a key which brought up a browser, went to Google and typed in Lucas's name. There were a dozen articles and 100 mentions or so, some with photographs. The sheriff read for a while, clicking through the articles, and then said to Todd,
"Says here Mr. Davenport is a wealthy patron of the arts in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Made his money in software. Don't say a thing about his fucking underage girls. Is that all true, Mr. Davenport?"
Lucas nodded.
"I guess."
An FBI computer specialist had done some editing of Lucas's history beforehand.
"You guess. Huh, you don't know for sure? Turner asked. Lucas said, yeah, that's me. You so rich you don't even carry cash. You just wave that black Amex card at people. You know what? Todd asked. He reached out and patted Lucas on the chest. Here we go.
He fished a second leather wallet out of Lucas's breast pocket, opened it, and said,
whoa, Daddy, he is rich.
He pulled out a wad of hundreds, spread it like a hand of cards.
There must be $5,000 here.
That's evidence, the sheriff said. Give it here. Todd handed him the money, and the sheriff put it in his jacket pocket, peered at Lucas for a few more seconds, then said to Todd,
take those cuffs off him.
When the cuffs were off, the sheriff said,
sit down, Mr. Davenport. I need to explain to you some realities of the world.
The realities, the sheriff said, were that both the deputies had been wearing body cameras, which he called Obama cams, and they clearly caught Lucas and Trist in the motel room. Trist, he said, had probably been ruined by the night's sexual experience, or, if not ruined, at least psychologically damaged. Long-term psychiatric care would be needed to fix that, and long-term psychiatric care wasn't cheap.
I got enough to send you off to the state prison for 5 to 10 years, but that's not going to do Trist any good, is it? She's still ruined, the sheriff said. I'm saying, between you and me, it might be better to cut our own little deal. I understand how you could have been misled, and everybody likes a little young puss now and then, but that's neither here nor there. She's still 15. You pay for her care, if those newspaper stories are right, you won't even miss the money, and we forget the whole thing. Or you can do the 5 to 10.
Lucas didn't say anything for 10 seconds, 15 seconds. Then he blurted,
you motherfuckers! You used that girl to set me up. That's what's going on here. She doesn't need that money. I bet you got her doing this 3 times a week.
The sheriff said, Todd, a little help? Todd swung harder this time, caught Lucas across the cheek with an open hand, knocked him off the chair. Lucas crawled in a circle on his hands and knees, could taste blood this time, and said, come on, don't hit me. Don't hit me again.
Couldn't help myself, the sheriff said, accusing me of some kind of public corruption. I don't take those kind of insults. Now get back up on that chair.
Lucas got back up on the chair, feeling the blood surging through his cheeks where he'd been hit. He'd have a hand-sized bruise in the morning. And the sheriff asked,
what's it gonna be? You wanna pay, or you wanna go to court? I gotta tell you the truth. We don't much care for Yankees down here.
Lucas dragged his hand across his mouth, tasting the salty metallic dash of blood. What are we talking about? How much? The sheriff considered for a moment and then said,
given what the crime is and given the fact that you're a rich man, $25,000. That sound about right?
Jesus, I don't have that much around. I don't have my checkbook with me.
What we do is this. You give me that American Express card and we'll fill out, right here, a bond statement bailing you out of jail. We bail you out for $2,000. Then you go back home and you send us a check. If you don't send us a check, we'll schedule you for trial and get in touch with the St. Paul police about extraditing your ass. If the check comes in, well, then it was a bad night and over. But you won't be hearing from us again.
I send you a check for $20,000. You already got 5 in cash.
And the watch, Todd said. That's a Rolex. I always wanted one of them. Give it here.
Not the watch. My wife gave it to me. It's engraved on the back.
The watch,
Todd insisted. The sheriff leaned back, amused.
Give it here,
Todd said,
or I swear to God I'll slap the shit out of you.
You gotta take the price of the watch off the rest. I'll get a new one, Lucas said. He unfastened the watch and handed it to Todd, who admired it for a few seconds, then put it in his pocket.
No, no. The full price is $32,000 plus the watch, the sheriff said, leaning back into the conversation. You put $2,000 on that Amex and send us $25,000 and we'll keep all of it.
How much does Trist get? I hope she gets something from you sons of bitches.
The sheriff smiled. Trist does all right. Better than working at McDonald's, getting all that smoke and grease up in your hair.
He leaned forward across his desk, fingers knitted together.
You look like a sophisticated man, Mr. Davenport. If you ever talk about this whole thing, the big headline's gonna say, Mr. Davenport fucks 15-year-old, and the little headline is gonna say, claims public corruption. Which headline do you think people will give a shit about? Which headline do you think your wife will give a shit about when Trist gets up on the witness stand and everybody gets a look at those titties?
Lucas said, all right. You've got the $5,000 in your pocket. I'll charge 2 more on the Amex. But I only send you 20 more. That's all.
You trying to bargain with me? The sheriff asked with the same shark-toothed smile. Because you're not in much of a position.
The office door opened and the deputy who'd led Trist away stepped back inside the room. His face was shiny with sweat and maybe regret, and the sheriff broke off to say,
What?
The deputy looked back over his shoulder, and then a dark gray semi-automatic pistol extended past his ear pointed at Todd's head, and the deputy lurched farther into the office, and a man in a blue suit with a wide gray mustache pushed inside and said,
Todd, I don't want to have to tell you twice, but if you move a hand toward your gun, I'll blow your brains all over Daddy's office.
The sheriff pushed back from his desk, a stricken look on his face. He'd already figured it out, but he asked anyway,
Who are you? Who the fuck are you?
Deputy U.S. Marshal James Duffy, Eastern District of Missouri. You are both under arrest. Got a long list of charges. We'll read them to you when we get up to St. Louis. Harry, you want to get in here, put some handcuffs on these gentlemen?
Another man in a suit edged past the gun, which was still pointed at Todd's head. The second man, Harry, spoke directly to Lucas.
Turner really wasn't dumb enough to put the money in his pocket, was he?
Yes, he was, and Todd put the watch in his pocket, Lucas said. I'd like to get the goddamn wire off me. My back is itching like fire.
You all right other than that? Duffy asked.
Yeah. Todd smacked me a few times but never touched the wire pack. I was mostly worried that somebody would see me flushing those margarita sponges down the toilet in the rooster room.
The second marshal cuffed Todd's hands behind his back and said to the sheriff,
On your feet, Mr. Turner.
That's Sheriff Turner.
Not anymore, the marshal said.
Todd began to cry, his wide shoulders shaking under the deputy's uniform. Then he looked at Lucas and said,
You asshole.
That'd be Marshal Asshole to you, Todd, Lucas said. The St. Louis marshals arrested 6 people, the sheriff, 4 deputies, and Shirley MacDonald. They'd be back later to get a state judge. After they put the cuffs on her, Shirley had started talking about being extorted by the Turners, and still hadn't stopped when they pushed her into a federal car and sent her north.
Them fucking Turners made me do it.
Todd and Scott made me suck them off, too. Ask them about that. I'm only 15.
It all made an interesting recording, and since the Marshalls read her rights to her a half dozen times and she talked anyway, it would all hold up in court. Before he got in the car, Lucas took a breath test which showed a 0.01 BAC, about what a man would get if he rinsed his mouth with whiskey a half hour before he took the test, which Lucas had done. That level implied no impairment whatever, in case a defense attorney should ask. The sting at Cooter's had begun when a widower federal judge had run into the same trap. Turner and his son had decided he might be more useful in his capacity as a judge than in his potential to pay his way out, and made a deal. The judge agreed to give them three verdicts, any three that could conceivably be seen as reasonable, and nobody would talk about young girls in motels. Three verdicts in the right corporate cases could be worth $1 million. But they'd misjudged the judge. As soon as he got back to St. Louis, he'd contacted the U.S. attorney and made a statement about the entrapment and blackmail. He'd admitted to having been alone in a room with a girl whose age he didn't know. He thought she might be 19 or 20, he said, but he made no other excuses. 2 days later, the St. Louis Marshal's office was checking around for a rich-looking marshal with a decent backstory. They found Lucas. The five arrested men rode north in a federal van with two deputy marshals to drive and watch over them. Duffy, the chief deputy for the Eastern District of Missouri, rode with Lucas in the comfort of the Big Benz. "One day ought to do it on the paperwork, but we'll need you back for depositions and so on," Duffy said. "We appreciate you coming down. Our own people are too well known. Couldn't take the chance that Turner might recognize them. Anyway, don't none of us got that slick veneer you actual rich guys got." "It's only a veneer," Lucas said. "Underneath, I'm just another really, really good-looking yet humble working cop." Duffy snorted and asked, "How's your caseload?" "I'm still looking." Duffy knew about Lucas's circumstances. A freelance deputy marshal slipped into the marshal's service through nothing but pure, unalloyed political influence wielded by Michaela Bowden, the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. Lucas had kept Bowden from being blown up at the Iowa State Fair the year before. He had been a marshal for 3 months and had gone through brief training at Arlington, Virginia, across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., most of which hadn't applied to him because of his special status. On the other hand, he really did have to know about the paperwork, which was ample. "There's some interesting stuff out there, but not really to my taste," Lucas told Duffy. "I'm looking for something hard, something unusual, something I can work at and would do some serious good." Duffy said, "Huh." He looked out the window at the countryside, damp, green, shrouded in darkness. A moment later, he asked, "You ever hear of a guy named Garvin Poole?" "Don't think so," Lucas said. "No? Then let me tell you about him." "Poole? Marvin?" "Garvin. Gar's a good old Tennessee boy. Maybe killed 10 or 15 innocent people, including at least one 6-year-old girl just last week, and a Mississippi cop some time back, and God only knows how many guilty people," Duffy said. "He's smart, he's likable, he's good-looking. He once played in a pretty fair country band, and he's got no conscience, none at all. He's got friends who'd kill you for the price of a moon pie. Some people think he's dead, but he's not. He's out there hiding and laughing at us. Yes, he is." Chapter 3. Margaret Train nearly ran over Lucas as she trotted out of the federal building, a solidly built cop in a hurry. She grabbed his jacket lapels and said, "Jesus, Davenport!" At the same instant, Lucas grabbed her shoulders and kept her upright and said, "Easy, Maggie." They backed away from each other and she said, "Hey, been a while. Was that girl down in Missouri as young as they say?" "She was young. She says 15, Lucas said. "Sort of horrifying, if you know what I mean."
"I do," Train said. She smiled up at him. They'd always had good chemistry, even when Lucas was Minneapolis's top violent crimes investigator and she was stuck in precinct investigations. They'd both moved on. Train to Minneapolis Homicide, Lucas to Minnesota's Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and then to the U.S. Marshals Service. "I hear things have been a little tense up in the Marshal's office."
"Ah, you know. It'll work out eventually," Lucas said.
"You got Bowdoin behind you, and she's going to be president. That ought to help."
"I try not to lean on that too hard," Lucas said. "But, yeah.
If you want to talk to some real cops, stop by Homicide. Happy to have you."
They chatted for another minute, spouses and kids. Then Train said she had to run. She had a conference call on a guy who was being bad in both Minneapolis and Denver. She jogged away, and Lucas went on into the federal building. Talking to Train had cheered him up. Because of the way he'd been appointed to the Marshals Service, he wasn't the most popular guy in the place. He'd been dropped in from the top, a deputy U.S. Marshal who sat in the Minneapolis office but worked independently and took no orders from anyone in Minneapolis, although he occasionally took recommendations and requests for help. His most direct contact was with a service bureaucrat in Washington named Russell Fort. He and Fort had met only briefly and had gone to lunch, and Lucas had gotten the impression that Fort was the best kind of apparatchik. Efficient, connected, more interested in results than in methods or style. So far, they'd gotten along. Lucas had an office on the fourth floor of the sort of modern-looking Minneapolis Federal Building, down the hall from the U.S. Marshal for the District of Minnesota and the other deputy marshals. The arrangement was complicated and one source of bad feelings on the part of a few deputies. The Marshal Service had a politically appointed U.S. Marshal at the top of each of the 94 federal judicial districts. They were appointed much as federal judges were, nominated by the president, usually at the recommendation of a U.S. senator and confirmed by the Senate. Below them were the civil service deputies, including a chief deputy, and below him supervisory deputies, and below that, the regular deputy marshals. Lucas stood outside that normal bureaucratic pecking order. And some in the Minneapolis office thought he might be a spy, for whom he had no idea, but that was the rumor. In addition, there was Lucas's private office, which had been, until recently, a windowless storage room. Still, it was private. The resentment was further exacerbated by the fact that he didn't have to put up with the bureaucratic rigors of the other deputies, the bad hours, crappy assignments. He didn't serve warrants. He didn't transfer prisoners. On top of it all, he was personally rich and arrived at work in either a Mercedes-Benz SUV or a Porsche 911. A federal judge with whom he was friendly had suggested a modest American car would be more discreet until he was better known inside the service. Lucas said, "Fuck 'em if they can't take a joke." The judge had said, "It ain't them who's getting fucked, my boy." The uneasiness wasn't confined to the other deputies. Lucas